Welcome to Road to Redline, the number one Porsche and car podcast celebrating the people and the stories behind the world's finest sports cars. Road to Redline is presented by YouTuber and magazine editor Lee Sibley, serial owner and columnist Joe Williams, and 993 owner Andy Brooks. Three enthusiasts on a mission to open doors and bring you the best stories, secrets, and exclusives from the world of Porsche.
The name Vaček Polák is synonymous with Porsche in the USA. The family-run business, spearheaded by Vaček Polák Sr., has long enjoyed a close relationship with the Porsche family and became the first standalone Porsche dealership in the States. The company has also enjoyed a stellar racing career preparing high-pedigree Porsche race cars, including the 917, 934, and 935, prepared for greats such as George Vollmer, Roger Penske, and Bob Hulbert. But as a Porsche enthusiast, you probably knew all that. What you won't know, however, is how this incredible family dynasty started until now. In today's episode, we're joined by Vaček Polák Jr., who talks anecdotally about his father's escape from Czechoslovakia in 1949, settling in California via New York, where Polák Sr. struck up a relationship with Max Hoffman, the man credited with bringing Porsche to the United States. Polák Jr. is charismatic and happy to chat, so buckle up and get ready to learn about the beginnings of this great American organization and how its legacy is being safeguarded today. Hi, Vaček. Lee here. Very nice to meet you and thank you for your time today. This is going to be a really interesting chat about your father's life, your father's business, and obviously your life and where you've kind of taken on the Vaček Polák business and dynasty then, if you like. So We'd really like to begin with your 993, though, first of all, because Andy's a 993 owner himself, and he's particularly interested in that car, it has to be said.
Yes, you know, I've been an enormously close friends with Hans Metzger since he visited us in Los Angeles in 1966 or 67. I don't remember exactly the year. And somehow, you know, how you have it with people, you click. And we clicked together with Hans. And every time I was in Stuttgart, I would go up to Weissach and say hi. And we spent many wonderful lunches at the casino after the casino was built. And so we had just a totally wonderful relationship. Actually, I even went to his very last birthday party that unfortunately got postponed by a week. And so I flew home without seeing him because he was still in the hospital. But I have very sweet memories about our meetings and all of this. And so coming back to the 993, I said, okay, how, if I wanted a car for myself, which I, you know, I have driven many cars, but I wanted to have one that was really special. And so I had a friend in Northern Germany that I would visit and look at his GT2 and 993 GT2. And also there was a 993 that was incredibly RS, you know, real RS car. But then when this incredible, crazy time have happened in London in December, or I don't remember, 3, 4, 5 years ago, one of them went for $445,000 or something like this. I was flying home and I was saying to myself, oh my gosh, you know, this is the end of my dream because, you know, I am just not going to spend that kind of money. Yeah. And about halfway over the Atlantic, I realized that, but what 993 RS is all about is the motor, the gearbox, the suspension, and so on. But it's basically a C2, right?
Yeah.
So as soon as I returned, I let everybody know that I am looking for 1995. So at least, you know, it's the right year. C2, and I had a really nice original 88 M3 BMW, and I am visiting a friend up in Lake Tahoe for the incredible wooden boat show, and I'm driving it with a huge smile going to Monterey, and I arrive to the hotel in Monterey in Carmel, and I get a phone call not 5 minutes after I walk into the room from a friend, and he said, 993 C2, $18,000. Would you be interested? I go, you got to be joking. And he goes, no, actually, it's a neighbor of mine. Oh, he has had the car, reached 82,000 miles or something, and he has had the car in his garage because he decided, hey, no, it's just mechanical things. I can repair the smoky heads, valve guides. So he took the motor out. And of course, after he totally disassembled it, he found out it was not as easy task. And then he got sidetracked and all of this. So this car has been in his garage forever.
Wow.
And he went over to my friend and he goes, you know, I have this Porsche car that has motor out in a basket. And would you know somebody that'd be interested?
How, that's just fate, isn't it? Total fate.
So it was unbelievable because I was just beside myself when he said that. I said, well, did you go and get it and put it in your garage before he changes his mind? And he said, no, you need to wire me the money and I'll do that instantly. And totally careless as to what was it, other than, you know, it was undamaged.
Yeah.
Had like 80 some odd thousand miles when they all start to smoke like crazy because of the bad valve guides that Porsche received from the supplier. And I said, hey, perfect. The motor is already apart. So we take it more apart, build it as a RS motor, and take the gearbox out, put the proper gears in it, put a limited slip in it. I don't remember now whether it had a limit. No, that one didn't have a limited slip. So anyway, I was incredibly lucky because the guy that was next door who called me was actually Carl van Austen from Jeff Gemrath's Radsport.
Ah.
You know, which is this amazing shop that we have just south of Portland.
Yeah.
And I go, hey, this is just the karma. You know, it's all coming together because I want you to work on it for me. And Jeff can do the motor. And he said, I can do the motor too. You know, so basically they hold everything away, a basket full of parts and all of this. And they build me an RS with an RSR suspension in it. So when you really think about it, I should say this. They had also a very astute guy that has been bringing cars in from Japan, and he brought a 1995 RS with like 7,000 kilometers on it from Japan. And somebody bought it, and this guy said, I want everything updated. I don't care what it is. Just take everything out and put all the new stuff in it for me. And so they offered him that tricky suspension that Singer is using on their DLS car, the DSL car. And so he won that and stuff. So I ended up with a RS suspension.
He stole it from him.
8,000 kilometers on it in my car.
You know,
so the original deal was, I wanted to experience what the real RS was. And so I got a 324 horsepower motor in it. I got a call from Jeff and Jeff Gemrath, and he goes, hey, do you want to sell your gearbox? And I go, what do you mean? He said, I have a guy that has an RS gearbox with a limited slip differential in it, the proper gears that I was going to sell you for $6,000. And he said, if you like, I send him the box. He'll send us his box and pay us $2,000. I go, why are you calling me? You know, you should have done this already. So the funny part was that the poor guy takes his, you know, quite nicely worn out box. He said to Jeff, he said, it has a gear noise and bearing noise or something. And I said, hey, don't touch it. You know, just maybe take it apart, look at the synchron rings and put it back with the gear noise and everything. I want it. Right? So they mm-hmm. did all this. And then, of course, my dear darling friend for, you know, since day one, since we met, also a guy that I clicked instantly, it was Kerry Eisenlohr from ERP Racing Products, and he does some really, really clever stuff. And he basically completely recreated the RSR suspension, the 993 RSR suspension, and he goes, yeah, there are some things that you want and there are some things that you don't want, but you need to, you know, raise up the cage with the box for so you can lower it and the suspension can work properly and all of this. So I go, you know, yeah, send it up, you know. And of course, again, you know, very friendly price at all of this. And Jeff and Carl put it together. And when you see the picture of the car standing on the front of their shop, you know, it's just perfect. I mean, it is sits right, drives right. And I also, my friends in England, I called up this company. I'm sorry that I can't think of. They sell wheels online.
Okay.
And Porsche wheels online. And yeah. I called him up and I got hold of the managing director, which was quite fun. And I chatted with him and I said, you know, I see that you have the original RS wheels. And and of course, I can get them also in America and all of this. But what really intrigued me was the price of their Michelin tires. And I said, how could I just get the tires? And he said, you order the wheels and tires. And when you come to the end of the order, you delete the wheels. So I just did exactly what he told me, and I am at our beach house, and I return home, and 3 days later, there are boxes with brand new Michelin tires for like half price. You know, I was just astounded, and the same thing happened with Alois Roof, you know, who has been enormously close, wonderful friend. And that's, you know, how you have assumed that it's a roof car.
Yeah.
And so, of course, as far as the mechanics, I bought the proper brakes from the RS because the master cylinders are the same, but the proportioning is different. And you shouldn't put a turbo brakes on it because it breaks more in the back. And, you know, it's all, so it's all proper RS. And I was looking for wheels. So I go to the Porsche factory to pay for an incredible bill for a 959S. And I said to the guy, I'm building myself an RS and I need a set of RS wheels. And he goes, yeah, you can go to the dealer and buy them. I said, yeah, but even with my discount and all of the stuff, it's a lots of money. And he goes, well, you know, Porsche factory is not in a business giving things away. I go, oh, okay, yeah, I can understand. So I go to Geneva to visit with my darling friend Alois, and I go, hey, you know, I am building myself an RS, and I would like to have a set of wheels, and they are being really, really silly about the price. Could you do something for me? And he said, I may have a set left, used or new, I'm not sure, because, you know, they stopped making them, and when Speedline went Benko, yeah. then he couldn't get any new ones anymore, and they destroyed the molds, and, you know, it was just a nasty deal. And he said, but I'll go home, and if I have a pair, I'll send you a pair. I go, how much? And he goes, you'll be surprised. And I go, okay, you know. So I arrive home one day from the beach, and there are four roof boxes. I still have the picture. brand new 993 wheels. So I called him up and I go, hey, what's going on? I told you I'd take any wheel because I'm going to refurbish them. And, you know, I didn't like the pedestrian gray. And so I wanted to have kind of a satin gray. And so he said, when you are next time in Europe, bring me some money and I will just, you know, come with money and we discuss it. So, of course, this was also, you know, in an incredible deal from Alloys. And so basically, I have a very nice car that drives better than an RS. It is just a load of fun to drive. And the only thing that totally blows me away that in those years, the gray, light gray, cold, kind of a bluish gray interior, everything like a gray bomb explodes in it. And so I have been talking about changing the interior forever. And so I got some really nice suggestions, one from Rob Dickinson. He and I are very close friends. And another one from another guy. But what sticks in my mind is the glorious looking roof car with a tan interior.
Yeah.
And I don't care for the black. So I am thinking about changing it to espresso. So whatever is black inside would be espresso,
yeah.
And the rest of it would be probably, you know, in that cognac, but not the Porsche cognac, a nicer, warmer cognac that the Porsche cognac. I don't understand why they even have that.
Yeah. So your car is Adventure Green, isn't it? Adventure Green, isn't it?
Yes, and it was
so
also
really
funny,
work.
You know. Right. So I immediately wire the money to the guy. He goes, picks it up. And I am thinking, what kind of a color is this? You know, no big deal nowadays, because I was even thinking welding the seams on the body and, you know, repainting it all away and stuff. And he goes, it's aventurine green metallic. You know, I'd call him like 3-4 days later. I said, oh, I forgot to ask you what color it is. And of course, I love white because all of our race cars that we picked up were white always, with the exception of the Interscope car, which was the first race car painted at the factory black, because that field wanted a black car. And he wanted black car from the factory. And father had a huge deal with them because they didn't want it to paint it black. So anyway, it was really great fun. And so I arrived back to my hotel and I clicked up on Aventurine Green Metallic, and here comes F.A. Porsche driving his 993 Speedster up the Grossglockner. And there are pictures of him and, you know, this glorious interior that he had made in dark brown, just like his Dachshund. And actually his Dachshund is sitting right there as he's driving it up. And Then the car is parked and all this light, sunny, beautiful day, must have been very early in the spring. And I keep looking at it. I said, oh, what a glorious color. And if F.A. Porsche selected it, oh, I am just happy boy. And it was also funny. The picture there is with two other guys and a third guy, kind of a passerby leaning against the railing, admiring the car. And but the two guys with F.A. were my close friends. One of them is Kaffer from there, who takes care of both the Piëch and Porsche cars, and he's standing there with his back, with his jeans. I spent some time in his house on my last visit there. And my dear darling friend Ottokar from Vienna, who just bought his 80th Porsche car on his 80th birthday.
Wow. Excellent.
Yeah.
Wow.
How cool was that? And, you know, he's there with this funny hat. And I go, oh, my gosh, you know, they are.
The stars are aligning.
So I was enormously happy. I am enormously happy with the car. And I especially, you know, when the interior will be done, it should be really, really fantastic.
You'll have to come back on, Vasek, and let us know how you get on with the car a little bit down the line, I think. It sounds like
a good project. For sure.
I'd like to touch on your father's story and particularly the beginnings of the business. So leaving Czechoslovakia in, I think it was 1949, wasn't it? And he landed in New York first before going to California, where the first standalone Porsche dealership was opened by you guys. Was Max Hoffman involved anywhere along there? I'm trying to kind of piece that together with Porsche's history.
Very much so. Actually, you know, when he arrived to New York, there's a whole bunch of history in between that. But by the time he arrived to New York, he went to Hoffman. And at first, I believe the first part was he met up with some people, some Czech people. And of course, he heard of General Motors, you know, General Motors plant somewhere in upstate New York and stuff. And they said, for sure, you can get a job there. So you know, my father was incredibly industrious, and he couldn't sit for 5 minutes. He had to do something. And so the next day, he goes to the Grand Central Station, gets on the train, gets popped up wherever the factory was, goes in, and they go, yeah, you are assigned to the truck line to put caps onto the chassis, and here is how you do it. So somebody took him there and showed him this big bolt with this gooey stuff on it, and he said, you put these two bolts with the gooey stuff into the chassis, and when the cap comes, there are these rather very large holes, so you don't push the bolts out, and you carefully align the thing to sit down on some whatever else was on the, and it goes down the line, and the other one you put some big washers and you know, tightens it and stuff. So of course that lasted one day.
It didn't find that too interesting.
not very interesting. So the next day he goes, okay, who is here that would make my life a little bit what I want it to be? Hoffman, right? So he goes into Max Hoffman's repair shop, which was separate from his glorious showroom in New York, and he walks in there, and there's a German, the head of the shop, and he goes, I'm looking for a job. And he said, you know, my father spoke fairly decent German, and so they connected in that respect. And he said, yeah, but I don't have any openings, and, you know, you come back in a week's time. And he goes, in a week's time, I'd be working for somebody else. give me a chance. And he goes, okay, see the Volkswagen over there in the corner? It has some problem with the gearbox, and the gearbox man doesn't come until tomorrow. Why don't you take the motor out, and so he has an easier time taking the gearbox? And he said, you know, it's easy to take the motor and the gearbox out for me. I'll be glad to do this for you. But as clever as my father was, he got into it and drove it first to see, you know, in the shop, to see what was wrong with it.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was a known defect that the fork for the moving of the inside of the gearbox would break. And he said, you know, this is stuck in the gear. It's obviously the fork is bad.
Yeah.
So he takes the motor out. The guy comes by, and, you know, 20 minutes later, the motor is out of the car on the ground. And he goes, you may as well take the gearbox out. So he takes the gearbox out. He puts it onto the stand where the gearbox guy was. First, you know, washes it, then cleans it, and all this stuff. And he goes, I know what's wrong with it. And he goes, yeah, so tell me. And he said, well, the fork is broken. And it's really easy to fix. You know, you just unbolt the back thing, you slide it out, but, you know, he basically gone with the guy over it. And he goes, if you're so smart, so why don't you take it at least apart? So he takes it apart. The guy comes back, looks at the broken fork. And my father said, do you have forks in stock? And he goes, of course we do. So he said, bring it. So he brings the forks. He puts it in. He adjusts everything properly, puts the gearbox back in, washes the engine so it looks brand new. My father was always, it had to look like you worked on it. You know, so
yeah.
We were always laughing. There were lots of racks in our shop, and we always made beautiful the engine bay. So when somebody opened it up and looked inside, you know, somebody worked on it. So he puts it all back together. It's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and manager comes and he goes, let's go for a ride. And so they go for, you know, all finished, you go for the ride, and they are like halfway through the ride, and he looks at him and he goes, by the way, you are hired.
What an interview. Fantastic.
So that's how he started. So he started to work for Max, and they actually became very close friends until Max died. I remember Max moving back to Santa Monica. He bought like 3 apartments on the top of this beautiful building, had them all connected. So, you know, it'd be just the top floor was his. And I remember going to the German store, buying bags and bags of food to bring into his glorious kitchen. And say bye-bye to him, and 3 days later, he was gone. Mm. So, but nevertheless, so my father was, you know, he was incredibly wonderful to know, and he was very personable and incredibly smart and incredibly good mechanic.
Yeah.
And what really happened was Max started to sell cars that people were racing, and my father, you know, raced motorcycles in Czech Republic. He also was one of the only, or he was the only person in Czechoslovakia that bought a Milia Fiat, you know, which was a tube frame aluminium glorious thing.
Yeah.
And he raced it in Brno in the Masaryk circuit through there, and of course left it behind. There's a story when he left it behind, a friend of his announced to him, you know, everything got confiscated what we owned, and a friend of his called him up and said they are bringing the car to some event in Austria, and my father escaped with the papers, keys and everything with him, that if it ever happens I am just going to show up, sit in it, and drive it away. Right? And they didn't show up. He hired a car, and he was in the hotel waiting for them, and they never showed up.
Oh.
But anyway, I have lots of beautiful pictures. Not lots of them, actually. I can only think of one, where he's sitting in the car at the Masaryk in Brno at the pit lane. You know. So anyway. Long story. So coming back to Max Hoffman, so he is working in a shop, and on weekends, he would take his Volkswagen bus and drive up to people's estates. And, you know, they were enormously generous. They would invite him to stay with them. And he wanted to just, you know, take care of their cars, and he would bring a mattress for the car, and when it got cold, he just let the motor run overnight to keep warm, and he would sleep in the bus, you know. Old Porsche mechanic, you know, like Porsche mechanics of the past used to do that too, you know. They went down to Sicily in a truck and slept in the back of the lorry and all this stuff. So anyway, he went, and I think it was Bridgehampton. Rex McAfee is still, you know, we are still very closely connected with Rex, which was, his father was Jack McAfee. And Jack had a spider and he had number 88 on it. And it was a funny story in itself because Jack, I asked Rex, how did father end up with an 88 number that my father just completely adopted as being the number that he loved the most because it made him so famous, you know, with the spiders.
Yeah,
with Jack Spider, actually. And Jack apparently was invited to the race. So he came from California to Bridgehampton. And then there was something wrong with the car. And one of the guys that was also racing Porsche cars, he said, hey, there's this Czech guy down the road that came from Hoffman. You should ask him. He's very clever. He can get it fixed. And so Jax sought my father. He came, and not only that he fixed it, he found out there were some other things wrong with it and stuff. And Jack was just beside himself how incredible the car ran. And and he said to my father, we need somebody like you in California. End of story. You know? That's how it happened.
Yeah.
He hated New York. He just absolutely hated New York. He said, you know, New York was like Willow Springs in California. It was never right. It was either too hot, too humid, too cold, you know, it was never right. So he was really looking forward to go to California.
Excellent.
And he was doing some work on a car and it backfired. And, you know, he was adjusting something and it kicked back and he somehow ended up with his finger in the pulley of the generator.
Ouch.
And so it bended the other way and it didn't break it. It just bended. But he said it was one of the most incredible pains that he had in his life. And he goes, okay, this is the time to quit because he had to have a hand some kind of a traction or something. And so he went to Max and told him, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, but I am leaving for California. And he goes, oh, okay. Maybe what you should do is to buy a Karmann from me. I'll sell it to you for cost and you can hook it up behind your bus and bring the car to California because you can make instant $1,500. And that time, you know, $2,000 and $3,500, you may as well talking about $200,000 and $350,000 today, yeah. Right? And so, you know, father was just beside himself that he would do this for him. So he brought him the money, paid him for the Karmann gear. But then what? He load up this Volkswagen bus and the rear wheels were like this. And he had a spare motor because, you know, for a European to cross America, you may as well fly to the moon and back.
Yeah. How long did that trip take?
Well, what happened? Let me just briefly touch on this Volkswagen deal. He goes, okay, now what? You know, so Michelin X tires all around. So he had the manager from the shop called the Michelin store and asked them how many pounds will the Michelin tire carry and how much he can inflate them. And he goes, it can carry a lot of weight if you put 90 pounds into them.
Jesus.
So basically solid wheels, right?
Yeah.
Basically solid wheels. So he gets two more tires mounted on wheels in case they go poof. But still the back is like this. So, you know, as clever as my father was, he climbs underneath with the jack, lifts it up and keeps looking, you know, until they are about right. And then he measures between the axle and the body piece. And he goes, oh, okay, that's the measurement. And he then goes and gets a wooden box with a slit on the top and a V-shaped piece on the bottom and puts it over the axle and gets two big 4x4 blocks of wood and lowers the bus onto the axles. And he goes, okay, now I can go to California. So also makes a the toe hook, and if you make a kind of an A-frame from the bumpers forward, so I took the bumper off, put an A-frame, and then put some kind of like moving blankets over the front of the car and all of this, and it goes, okay, I'll tow the Carmangia, right? 34 horsepower motor.
Oh my God.
Overloaded like crazy, towing a Carmangia.
It must have taken him weeks.
So there was a wonderful friend of his who he had asked to come and work for at Hoffmann also. And he was incredibly clever, a Czech guy with a family. And the Czech guy said, I am going to California also. If you are leaving, I'm going with you. So they followed with a some kind of a station wagon, you know, monster station wagon, and his daughter and his wife in it and stuff. And they are going, and he said, I remember the beautiful plains, you know, going through them, and suddenly I come to Colorado and they are these enormous mountains. And he said, as soon as I came to the bottom of one, the Volkswagen said, okay, I had enough.
I'm not surprised.
So he said, I'm sitting there and I just can't get up the hill. And I'm sitting there, maybe it's time to change the motor. But then, you know, there's this craze about the Meyer monks in California. They're putting chassis with Volkswagen motor onto this glorious looking body. Maybe I should not do this and sell the motor when I get there and all of this. And as he's sitting there over the steering wheel, suddenly a brilliant idea, you know, my father was full of them, comes to him. He goes, bloody hell, I have a brand new Volkswagen behind me. It can push me up the hill. So he goes back, he shifts it into the gear, turns the key on, puts something, you know, on the carburetor at full throttle, and jerks with it, the thing starts, and happily they made the top of the hill. Steps on the brakes, the thing dies behind him, he turns everything off, puts it out of the gear, and continues on.
Coasts all the way to California.
They go through Las Vegas, and the friend decides that he wants to go and visit the casino. And he has a $1, I think they were silver dollars, and there was a huge slot machine. And the friend said, you know, I have one last silver dollar with me. I'm going to try it. So he puts it in, pulls the thing, and hits a jackpot and gets 100 of these silver dollars out of the machine. So he was just beside himself, you know, how lucky he could be. Well, they proceeded on, and when they got down into San Bernardino, there was still no San Bernardino freeway. So father is driving the bus in the front, and they go on Foothill Boulevard, and it ends up into Sunset, and it ends up, you know, right at Santa Monica. And finally they arrive there, full moon, glorious California night. And they arrive to the T intersection where basically the Foothill Boulevard ended into Pacific Coast Highway, the Highway 1. And, you know, again, the clever part of my dad, he's sitting behind the steering wheel looking to Malibu and sees just few little flickering lights. He looks to the left and see lots of lights in Santa Monica and all this. You know, more business that way. So makes the turn and they come up Pacific Coast Highway through Manhattan Beach. And Manhattan Beach all the way to the Aviation Boulevard, which is, 2 miles or so, is nothing but sand. And so they are sand dunes, you know, covered with the asphalt. And when he comes to the highest point, there's Artesia Boulevard. And or before Artesia, I'm sorry. One hill before Artesia. And he comes up, and there's the bay, and there's red light. And he goes, this is it. So he pulls to the red light and goes to the left. And as he is making the left turn, he sees this building at 356 South Sepulveda Boulevard.
Very good number.
Yeah. You know, so they just passed the motel and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. So they go into the motel and he walks to the place because as they drove through the back, he notices that there is a parking for whatever, and there was some insurance office on the corner, and there was a huge parking place. And so he's walking down to ask the insurance guy who owns the building and whether he can rent the space behind, because it also had a garage to the building, and which he then turned into a machine shop. And it already had a concrete slab there. And somebody must have used for some automotive deal because there was also a fuel pump in you know, kind of a sitting there. So the fuel pump went away. Eventually, holes got drilled into the concrete with these massive car lifts, and then eventually he had it covered. And on our website, there are many beautiful photographs that we were able to assemble, you know, from this location. 356 South Sepulveda Boulevard.
Just meant to be, wasn't it?
Yeah, just meant to be.
Absolutely.
And then he was working on, you know, so instantly, of course, Jack let the word out that Vasek is in California. So not only that he worked on regular Porsche cars, and also, you know, he would take in Volkswagen to service. But, of course, his love always was race cars. So all the people that were involved with race cars would suddenly bring him the cars in. And he would work on the customer cars during the day and work on the race cars at night. And his office was actually his sleeping room. There was a shower and a bathroom with a shower. So he had this couch that he would open and sleep on whatever hours he was able to sleep. He said, ideally, I need to come up with an idea how I don't have to sleep. You know, that was. And he was incredibly industrious, save every penny. And I never forget when he made my mother to drive to Pasadena to a German store to buy stuff because he didn't want to buy it from Ernie down the street because he was too expensive. So my mother took this, you know, 7-liter Cadillac and drove to Pasadena for an hour on the freeway. Bought some stuff, and so I used to laugh. I said, we have to save money no matter how much it costs.
Vasek, I want to bring it back to the Porsche and motorsport side of things. So obviously, you guys, by the mid-60s, had opened up in California. It was the first standalone Porsche dealership. Great place to be, by the way, wasn't it, considering the boom that California had for Porsche? How important was the racing for you guys then? Because there are some fantastic cars that have had the Vasek name attached.
Clearly, you know, it was my father's passion, right? So it was, he saw the potential of the Porsche car being, you know, loved as by many people as he could show as to how well engineered it is and how incredible it is to drive and all of this. So not only did he capture this incredibly large crowd of the current racers, both with 356s and Spiders, but primarily with Spiders. And it was funny, you know, Johnny von Neumann and his wife were the ones that came to California to become the distributor for California, Arizona, Utah, and Hawaii. And so he was the distributor for Porsche. And he had two Porsche mechanics from the Porsche factory, yet he still would bring the Spider for his drivers to my father to work on it.
Wow. He said,
when did your when did your father first end up, you know, in the seat of one of the race cars? Because I take it he was obviously looking after other people's cars. When did he first make that jump to being in the seat?
It was actually, you know, because he was so good in motorcycles, he was toying with the idea, maybe also driving. And I don't know whether it was Jack's idea or whose ever idea to let him drive the Spider. But, you know, as we know nowadays, you spend weeks and weeks and weeks to get it to where you really feel comfortable and all of this. And there was a race at the Paramount Ranch, and Ken Miles was there. And there's a glorious picture of him passing him, and it looks like my father is passing Ken Miles, which is kind of a cute. You know, Ken is on the inside, my father is on the outside. It looks like he's taking the long line passing him. But right afterwards, he loses it and spins it through the overpass. And he said, right there and then, I decided I am not going to race. I'm going to take other people's, care of other people's cars. And that was it. So his driving career in America consisted of that one outing at the Paramount Ranch where there were a whole bunch of spiders. And you know, he really didn't have much experience in it. Mm. He would only work on it at midnight, sit in it, drive it down Artesia Boulevard, you know, just to make sure that it ran right. And bring it back and put it in a trunk and drive it to Arizona or drive it to Laguna Seca. And so a couple of really funny stories about driving to Arizona and to Laguna Seca. There was a very astute chap named Stan Sugarman, and he almost became the distributor for Toyota in America. And during the negotiation with the Japanese, he had a heart attack and died in the hotel room. But he had a stable. He had three spiders, and he would bring a truck with two spiders, you know, regular truck with two spiders on the top and a trailer with a third one behind. And he would drive it up and he goes, I'm flying home and you bring the truck to Arizona. And he goes, okay. So after he was all done, he, you know, they loaded it all up and he goes, I sit in it and I'm just tired like hell, and I still have to go, you know, all the way to Arizona. And if you guys ever been in a desert gets incredibly cold in the nighttime, even in a nice time of the year. And so he's driving to Arizona, and he is so bloody tired that he can't see anymore. So he pulls over from the highway. And he decides to park in the front of a telephone pole and in a wire pole. And he just lets the motor run, you know, pulls out the handbrake and all this stuff and lets the motor run so the cap would stay warm. And he leans over the steering wheel and sleeps, falls asleep. And I think I inherited it from him. I sleep for 20 minutes exactly, not 19 and not 21, but 20 minutes later, I wake up and I can drive another 1,000 miles. So he's leaning over the steering wheel and his foot on the gas, and he is laying there, and suddenly he hears the motor just in an incredible RPM, and he wakes up and sees the telephone pole right on the front of it. And he said, I grabbed the steering wheel and turned. And suddenly I realized I was standing still. So, you know, of course he would have flipped the truck, not a question, right? But that was one thing. And then the other the other quick story was, he was driving to Laguna Seca, not very familiar at the time, you know, how do you get to Laguna Seca? And it stops in San Luis Obispo. And he goes, what's the shortest way to Laguna Seca? And the stupid guy tells him, go along on Highway 1. You know, not to go up to Salinas and make a left turn and you are there. Go on Highway 1. Well, Highway 1 is like this, you know, everywhere. And he comes like halfway and there is this enormous boulder. And he goes, now what? You know, I can back up, can't do anything. So he uses the bumper of the truck and his jack and stuff, and eventually gets the boulder over to the other side and, you know, fall into the ocean. And he continues, and he goes, I want to stop and kill the guy on the way back, you know, who told him to go that way. And when he stopped by the gas station, the guy had the day off. So anyway, so back to the racing story. So, you know, he had worked, there's a picture on the website that has all these spiders all around on this piece of concrete that I mentioned behind the office. And it was funny also over the insurance office. One time he was late preparing one of the forecam engines for the spider. So he go, oh, I'm going to put it. He had a little portable dyno. So he put it on the portable dyno and started it up, you know, with a Sebring exhaust. And he was running it, and the building was shaking. The secretaries from the insurance company went underneath the desk, thinking it's an earthquake. He said, actually, it worked out perfectly because that was the end of the insurance company, and I had a nice showroom for the dealership. So that was kind of a funny too.
And is that the same site is that the same site that became the new Porsche dealership? Is that did it stay on the same
correct.
Site?
Yeah, the same. You know, from the you know, the round corner of 356 Sepulveda. So then, of course, he bought the building from the guy, and then he tried to buy the building next door. And my father was very clever, you know. He always done lease purchases. Okay. So whatever money he had put into it in leases, they apply for the purchase price.
Yeah.
So, you know, all his acquisitions were incredibly clever. And wow. He amassed this enormous holdings in real estate and all this stuff, because he had a friend that was in the real estate business, and she would always show up and said, there's a house in Manhattan Beach that is you should buy. And since he had the wherewithal, he would go and buy it, you know. And these things are millions now. Unfortunately, we don't own any of it anymore, but one house, we just kept the family house. I kept them a family house. So it's still there. And the when you would look at the price, what it was when father bought it and what it is today, you would just laugh like crazy, because seemed like everything there goes up 30% no matter what the economy is doing every year. You know,
what sort of age were you when you've got, you know, distinct memories of being around Porsche and being around the racing and the race
cars?
Well,
you know, I actually was 1 year old when he left, and when I arrived, I was 18.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So I haven't, you know, the whole family hasn't seen father for 17 years.
Okay. Yeah.
And he was always saying to my mother, she said, you did such an incredible job with the kids that when I speak to them and so and so it's like I went on a business trip and came back. He said, you know, this embracement from the family was just huge. And but you know, he grew up to be by himself and independent and all of this. And so he didn't have the feel for the whole family as much as we had the feel for him. Which was kind of a sad for me to realize eventually when there was some friction between him and my sister, you know, that I went to his office and I said, what you said to my sister last night, I see that you are not feeling the same thing toward us as we feel toward you. Yeah, it was very difficult for me to say. But anyway, Porsche cars. I came... we landed in Los Angeles January 11, 1966. We came to New York, we came from Prague, British Airways, European Airways to London, Pan Am from London to New York because they canceled the Los Angeles flight. We got on American Airlines and flew into LA in the afternoon. Still the parking lot, you know, just empty parking lot, the structure already, the center structure already there. no elevated roads, no garages, nothing. And there was this enormous Cadillac Fleetwood convertible. And so we all piled up in it and drove home to this house that we still have. The next day, I was with my father walking to the store, which was walking distance. And I got introduced to everybody, and there were some really wonderful German mechanics. And Mila Sackner was still there, the guy that came from New York. He's in one of the pictures, kind of leaning over the Furman motor, where my father is sitting in the Spider from the I think it says Competition Motors on the side, which was the privately owned dealership of Johnny von Neumann. But anyway, so I came, and one of our first tasks was to go get the 911 when the 911 was brought to the US. Father wanted to race it, and he goes, "I want a white car." And Jack McAfee's dealership in Burbank has one, so let's go and exchange it. So we piled up into the silver 911 that we had, and drove over there and got the white car. And we are coming back on Harbor Freeway, and you know, my father said, "Always be very observant, because." You don't want it to be involved in other people's accidents. And so we are driving back, and there's this, or was, there's not anymore because they reworked the intersection. At the Harbor Freeway and Artesia Boulevard, which we would take off, there was this long exit with a red light on the end. And he's coming off, and I look at him, and I see that, you know, I feel the car going like this, and I see him looking in the mirror, and he's looking in the mirror, looking forward, looking in the mirror, and suddenly he jumps onto the center divider, and here comes some Oldsmobile or something and runs into the car in the front of us like you wouldn't believe. Then he goes, "You need to be observant." Yeah. You know, so we back up, go around it, because we're immediately a lot of people there and stuff. He said, "Let them handle it. We have work to do." So we drove to the place, and we arrived, end of the afternoon, and we started to take the 911 apart right there and then. We waited for nothing. So we basically completely disassembled the car, and I went to him and I go, "How do you take the rear window out?" And he goes, "You pop up the chrome rim, which is the locking thing for the rubber, and then you walk in and you press with your back and the window pops." So I go back, you know, take the chrome rim off, go inside, press, goes poof, pops. And then it pops up. So I do this, and he comes to the shop, and he goes, "What happened to the window?" I said, I gave it to Arnold to the parts department. And he goes, "Oh, I forgot to tell you, it breaks 9 times out of 10 when you do this." So beginner's luck. So we took everything out, and we took the motor apart. And I remember he didn't want to spend the money for Bridgeport. So he had this really nice old lathe, and we would do things which you would do normally on the Bridgeport on the lathe. And so when it came to make the little holes for the intakes into large holes, we would put a big bore into it, make this little deal to hold it on, and drive it into the head of the lathe. And I was doing all the work. You know, he would just walk from his office and tell me what to do, not to do. And he was pretty mad at me that at one point I needed to kind of make a little bit more of a, so I was sitting on the top of the rails, holding it in my hands, you know, kind of feeding it into the head of the thing. And he just, no, not that way, you know. So So we built the motor, and he was extremely good in adjusting carburetors. We had these boxes of jets and air correction jets and main jets and idle jets and, you know, Venturi, every Venturi that was useful to us. And if it wasn't useful to us, we bored it out and, you know, made new shapes and stuff. And then we would go to Riverside and test the car. And when we were coming home, the driver at the time was Jerry Titus. He was really wonderful. He was, my father said, you know, everybody dipping their chassis in the acid and they make up the strength with tubes, you know, saying, oh, this is a roll cage. Well, it's actually a chassis for the car. And then the rest of the sheet metal is just, you know, to show that the car is still there. But don't go and try to press on it with your thumb, because your thumb will probably go right through or make a huge dent. But we have our own original production car, and it is so fast and soft because we have an unfair advantage, as Mark used to say, Mark Donahue. We had a driver that was like a jockey, you know. So not only that we were trying to make everything super lightweight, but we also had a lightweight driver, so it was fun. And one time we were coming home, and we would always take everything apart and look for some problems. And before we would do that, we would take the filter out and cut the filter in half. And one day we come home and we cut the filter in half, and he goes, finding gold in the filter is a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, oh, so bearings, huh? He said, yeah, there is a problem with the bearings. Clearly not main bearings, but the rod bearings. They are being overworked. So we kept taking the motor apart and finding, and we found out that the early crankshafts were fed through, I think it was on cylinder number 3. I can't remember 100%, but it was fed from the main bearing to the cylinder, to the outside, and then the oil had to go clear across to feed into the next bearing. So of course the centrifugal forces made that bearing really starve. Yeah. So I said, "What are we going to do?" And he goes, "We cross drilled the crank. Are you going to do it?" I go, "What do you mean?" So he brought this grinder to go through the hardened part of the crankshaft. And he goes, there's this long drill, and you drill right through so it comes out in the main bearing. And then we take the main bearing and make a groove from in it to be able to feed the connecting rod. So I am drilling, and suddenly, bam, and the drill breaks.
Okay.
So I go to him and I go, I don't know how to tell you this, but the drill broke. And he goes, I thought it may, but I got another one. I got another one. Come, I'll grind some more and just drill right next to it. So I did. And that one came on the other side, and we modified the bearings, and we were the only ones that didn't have a problem. And when 1970 came, and they still had problems in 1970 with Johnny von Neumann had the engine 914.6. I remember my father told me that they brought the 914.6 over, and he did the modification, even though they were still losing rod bearings. And he made the modification for them. And then, of course, since then they didn't, because what they did, they went home and took the motor apart and found out what they did.
So back then, were all those sort of tricks, were they kept under your hat? Was that your racing advantage, so to speak?
I think that our racing advantage was in the drivers for sure. The other advantage was that father was incredibly clever about setting up the motors and figuring the gears just right. You know, many people, they just raced and left everything alone. Nah, we had boxes of gears and we had stuff. And we were not afraid to, you know, go to Riverside and pull stuff apart and do it right there and then. And you know, the driver is such an incredibly integral part of the team. Not only that because he's driving, but, you know, the feedback from him. And all of our guys are just incredible in feedback. So we were able to adjust the suspension and we were able to do this and we were able to, you know, so we always were ahead of everybody, which was really great fun. And we even, when the gearboxes were 5-speed, we even took the reverse gear out and made a 6-speed out of it.
Oh wow, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, yeah. And one friend came and he goes, "He's shifting again on a long straightaway. Nobody's doing it." You know? I said, "Oh, you heard something, you know." Yeah,
Vashek,
good fun.
I have to say, it's been awesome hearing so many anecdotes from you. You've clearly got so many here. We know there's a book coming, isn't there, in 2022?
Yes.
What we'd also like to know as well, Vashek, is what of the story of the business today? I understand there's the Vashek Polak collection. So if you wouldn't mind kind of just explaining that and how you want to kind of safeguard your father's awesome racing legacy with Porsche.
I think that there are a lot of things written, and you know, a lot of it I have to laugh when I see it. And so I cooperated this with my darling daughter Maury on this, who suddenly realized there's so much there that we should not. I am the last Polak on this planet. All the siblings on my father's side are gone. All their children. The only male child is gone. So I am the last Polak. And she said, "When you die, it's over. And I hope you're not going to do it soon. So, you know, let's get this all together and tell the story how it really was, rather than, you know, the people that are trying to make stories out of it and they get it all wrong, you know." So. Yeah. So that's what we are trying to do.
Vashek, I mean, some of the anecdotes you've told us tonight have been brilliant, certainly in terms of where you and your family have come from into creating that business that went right to the top, right to the very pinnacle of the Porsche industry, both commercially speaking with the dealership and, of course, on the racetrack. We just want to say, look, thank you very much for spending some time with us today and sharing some fantastic anecdotes.
I hope we can do some more when the time comes and you have time and I have time. And, you know, we are still incredibly close to the Porsche family and also some members of the PX family. And Wolfgang and I are good friends. And so it's all good. So all good and fun. And I love everybody that is, you know, involved with Porsche cars.
Excellent. No, like I say, yeah, that's been awesome. And particularly, I think it's important to get the story across here in the UK, because obviously there's plenty of people have heard of the name, but not everybody, particularly, like I say, here where we are. So it'd be our pleasure to kind of further that in the minds of our listeners. So.
Right. Yeah. I look forward to meet you someday in person. And, David Richards is a good friend of mine, and Gordon Murray I need to go and visit. He keeps inviting me to come and drive his car, and so we need to reconnect in England someday.
Absolutely, I'd love that. Yeah, David Richards in particular, he's a smashing guy with a amazing history of what he does with the rally cars. So
indeed, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, wonderful. Yeah, Vashek Polak Jr., thank you very much indeed for joining us on Road to Redline.
Quite welcome. Until next time.
What a charismatic bloke, hey?
Yeah, definitely can say
indeed.
That. I'll tell you what's going to make an interesting read is when they get their book out. What do you reckon to that?
Yes, great shout. And actually, as part of the book coming out, there's also a website which we encourage you to go and check. It's vasekpolakcollection.com. The Vashek Polak Collection is essentially an online hub of storytelling, memorabilia, and expertise. It's all designed, along with the book, as you mentioned, Joe, to safeguard the legacy of Vashek Polak for future generations.
I think there's plenty of space for another episode with Vasek.
Oh, I think so. He's definitely happy to chat, isn't he?
Yeah, we've got plenty more stories left there. So
we need to hear about some of these race cars, don't we? Because I think that's the rundown we've missed out on, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got the early story. I think there's much more to come.
Yeah,
so definitely. Maybe another episode sometime.
Yes. Yeah, we'd love to have Vasek Jr. back on. Indeed. Yeah, that's about it. I suppose we'll see you guys next week for another stellar episode via Friday's virtual.
Yeah, I was just going to say, haven't you got something on this Sunday,
Lee? Yeah.
So tell us about it.
Well, because Andy, we're all stuck at home at the moment for this lockdown that seems never ending, isn't it? So we've decided to do, I've decided to do a 996 virtual meet via the power of Instagram and Instagram Live. So join in 2 p.m. GMT on my Instagram page, and I'll be chatting to a load of 996 owners from around the world, I'd like to point out.
Excellent.
With some specialist advice as well for some people in the industry that know what they're talking about. That's not me, by the way.
Who have you got on? Who's your guest of honor?
I'm going to keep it closely guarded for now. Ooh. I think, yeah,
just in case it doesn't come off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the thing. Like, I had this kind of idea that I thought of in the dead of night one time, and I couldn't sleep. And I thought that'd be really good to do a virtual event, and let's do it on Instagram Live. But if I'm totally candid with you, I've no idea if it's going to work or not. I've never tried it before, so I've got all these like good intentions, but who knows? But yeah, as I say,
so maybe tune in for some Sunday comedy then.
Well, yeah, when it all goes belly up. Without a doubt, it's probably going to be the higher entertainment value. Yeah. But while we don't have the chance to drive our cars at the moment, at least we can kind of celebrate them and have a good old chinwag in the meantime. So
sounds like it's got potential. Fingers crossed it all goes well.
Well, hopefully. And then, you know, maybe we could do one time where we can get everybody involved. We'll have to see if it works, first of all. This will be a very scary pilot. So
but you test it.
Yeah, 2 p.m. GMT on my Instagram page for the lot. So
awesome. Good luck with that.
Nice one. Thank you, fellas. Any other news that you guys want to
We've got discuss? a few new Patreons that have very kindly signed up, haven't we?
We have, but I haven't got them in front of me. So let's discuss that next week. Yeah,
I think we're about to kick off and launch the Roof Nozomi watch collab, aren't we?
So
So look out for the competition. And obviously, if you are a Patreon member, then you get a double entry. So it's worth signing up as well.
Yes.
I believe they're actually sold out, aren't they? So this would be your last opportunity to get one.
Ooh, nice.
Sold out already.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, both that, Ruth and Nozomi.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, anything remotely associated, even if it's indirectly with Porsche, that's numbered and sold out, that usually creates an overs market. So we might be sitting on gold here, boys.
Indeed.
What are we giving it away for? Hey, yeah. Highest bidder, surely.
Yeah.
Yes, but unfortunately, it won't be going on any of our wrists. It'll be going to one of you lovely listeners at home. So enter the competition, please do. As Joe said, it's double dip for the Patreon members. Two chances to win that. And that's a stellar prize, isn't it?
Yep. Indeed.
Cool.
Nice one, chaps. Good to see you as always. We'll see you and everybody at home next week.
Will do. Cheers now. Bye.
You've been listening to Road to Redline, the number one Porsche and car podcast fueled by our generous Patreons. If you'd like to join in supporting the podcast, please see patreon.com/roadtoredline and find us on Instagram.